You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of December 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Hong Kong's police clear the last of three main protest sites. CY Lung says it's all over, but is it? We'll get the view from our experts here in the studio, lecturer Alessio Patilano and journalist Mary Dajewski. Also on tonight's agenda, Sweden says a Russian military jet nearly hit a passenger aircraft last week. Russia says it didn't. We'll ask, not for the first time in recent memory, what Moscow thinks it's doing. And Belgium's skies are on strike.
Since yesterday 10 p.m. and until today 10 p.m. we have no flight above Belgium. It means for Brussels airport that the 600 flights are cancelled. The impact is huge because we expected today 50,000 passengers and today they cannot fly it.
As trade unions ground flights, halt trains and close offices nationwide, we discuss the reforms and the cuts bugging Belgium. Also coming up.
They took what they wanted, whether it was Hitler or Stalin, Napoleon. They all had motives and they went after huge quantities of art.
A short history of stolen art with the author Ivan Lindsay. All that plus music and much more besides coming up right now on Midori House on Monocle 24. So lots coming up, as always, in the next hour here on Midori House. But ahead of all that, James Luckhurst has the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. Police in Sydney say the cafe siege is over. Australian commandos stormed the premises, ending a siege by a gunman identified as an Iranian refugee who took dozens of people hostage. Paramedics carrying stretchers followed the commandos towards the cafe. Several people appear to have been injured. The fate of the gunman is not yet known. A police source in Sydney says an Iranian refugee facing several charges of sexual assault has been named as the armed man holding hostages. Manharon Monis, a self-styled sheikh, is known for sending hate mail to the families of Australian soldiers killed overseas.
This pen is my gun, and these words are my bullets. I'll fight with these weapons against oppression to promote peace. We should care about Australia's interest, not America's interest. We are Australian.
The Turkish president Tayyip Erdogan has lashed out at the European Union after it criticized the mass arrest of opposition journalists at the weekend. Mr. Erdogan said the EU should mind its own business and keep its own opinions to itself, denying that the raids had infringed press freedom. EU leaders have said the arrests were incompatible with European values. At least 24 journalists said to have close links with a US-based cleric are being held for plotting to seize power. The UN says around 4,700 people have died in Ukraine's separatist conflict since September. That's when a ceasefire was technically declared. The UN says there have been repeated shelling in the east of the country between government forces and pro-Russian rebels. It's warning the situation, which has now lasted 9 months, is becoming increasingly dire. Hong Kong authorities have arrested several pro-democracy activists as they clear the last of three protest sites. The move marks the closure of demonstration camps in the city that have blocked streets for more than 2 months. About 100 police swept into Causeway Bay, a shopping district popular with mainland Chinese tourists, to remove barricades as protesters scrambled to pack up belongings from the smallest of the three main sites. At least 51 people are now known to have died from a mudslide that engulfed a village in Indonesia. More than 50 people are still missing from Friday's incident in Jemblong village on the island of Java. Hundreds of rescuers have been digging through mud and wreckage, searching for survivors. John Kerry and Benjamin Netanyahu have been in Rome for talks on de-escalating tensions between the Israelis and Palestinians. The US Secretary of State wants to push the Israeli Prime Minister to withdraw from occupied Palestinian territories. Mr. Netanyahu has indicated he has no intention of agreeing to that proposal and has said he's hopeful the UN won't set a deadline when it meets to discuss the issue. Russia is also involved in the talks. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has already discussed the issue with his US counterpart.
Middle East issue is crucial for making sure that we don't allow this situation to degrade further, and I would be very much interested in discussing what we can do together to avoid this.
Belgium armed police have stormed an apartment in the western city of Ghent. The action has ended a siege after reports that gunmen had taken a hostage there. A spokeswoman for state prosecutors said the victim was safe and well, and three other men have been detained. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monocle 24 です.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, just gone 18.06 here in London. That'll be 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, we have Alessio Patilano, lecturer in war studies at King's College, and Mary Dijewski, chief editorial writer and columnist at The Independent. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Hong Kong, where promises and threats by the authorities to finally roll up recent pro-democracy protests now feel like they've been going on longer than the protests did. But the final site at Causeway Bay has now been cleared, occasioning several arrests. Mary, first of all, are you surprised by the patience that the authorities have shown?
Well, I think in some ways they had very little choice, really, because the effect of breaking up this demonstration, which was at least for the first few weeks decidedly peaceful, the international effect for China would have been colossal. So I think that they had to play it softly, softly. They really had no choice.
Alessio, for those of us now sufficiently old that we remember it quite well, you had a spectacle in a Chinese city of large numbers of idealistic young students camped out demanding democracy. It did not summon up happy memories. What's the difference between now and Tiananmen Square? Is it just the difference between Hong Kong and China, or is it the difference between a closed society and an open world?
I think the difference can be sort of understood at two different levels. First of all, this time we don't have tanks rolling around. That's very important. At one level, it's the reaction of the government was very different from last time. Last time it was to put a stop on something that they didn't see particularly coming, and they weren't happy with it when it came around. It was an act of defiance that was just not conceivable, especially because it was in Tiananmen Square, so it was at the very heart of China. This time around, was in a very different, very firm position. You know, the authorities in Beijing never really changed their position about the fact that they would not concede on who was going to be able to present himself or herself insofar as the elections in Hong Kong were concerned. On the second level, however, I think what we're looking at is also a different type of protester. I think that the current situation showcases an awakening of a different type of society. It's not a case that it is in Hong Kong and is from Hong Kong where the requests are coming. We're looking at a type of audience these days that is not only tired with the way the promises that the government in Beijing has done to people in Hong Kong in terms of how they would progressively allow them to take control of their economic activities and sort of political life. I think it also is not just about one section, a small section as it was in Tiananmen Square. It is a larger section. This is like the majority of the people in Hong Kong were kind of sick and tired of a certain way of doing it. They were expecting more, and they weren't really given that.
Mary, have they accomplished anything? Because there is, not wishing to appear overly sympathetic to Beijing, but they are in an obvious bind in that, as you pointed, for all the reasons you pointed out, a severe crackdown would have been disastrous, and yet you can sort of see from their point of view that if they make any democratic concessions to Hong Kong, the idea of that catching on elsewhere in China doesn't please them either. Have the protests accomplished anything, do you think?
Well, I think maybe they haven't accomplished anything in the short term, or maybe before the elections that they were talking about in 2017. What I think they have shown is that opinion in Hong Kong, there is a new wave of not accepting rule as it's operated from Beijing. In the past, I tended to think, and I covered a lot of the talks with the British on the agreement, which is now being contested. And the interesting thing is that between then, which is the mid-late 80s, and now, there was almost a sort of quiescent, calm acceptance in Hong Kong of almost anything that was sort of imposed on them in terms of changes in political expectations. Now I think we've seen something quite different. We've seen a new generation saying that they are politically aware and maybe in the long term they're not prepared to accept what's being imposed on them. And I think that is far, far more important than whether they've won the short-term struggle.
I think actually this is a very important point. This movement, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is a lot more resilient than anything we've seen before. What we're looking at is the thing. See, the fact that it simply lasted much longer than one would expect it, and there were still people, obviously in much smaller numbers, but there were still people even over the past few days. And I think, but at the national level within China, there is an awakening. And an awakening and the resilience of that awakening process, it's because pretty much everybody is coming to the stage where they have a greater consciousness and awareness of themselves and their importance to what they bring into China. Mind you, and this is not just at the domestic level, this is for all Chinese people in a way, because even in Taiwan, I think there is, if we're talking about the immediate consequences of these protests, of course it's not in China or in Hong Kong because nothing has changed. But look at what is happening just next door, across the strait in Taiwan, where the last local elections, DPP was extremely successful. Part of it is because DPP has a clear sort of distanced itself from China and mainland China. And this is one of the reasons why they've been so successful, because they're making the point that the younger generations in particular, if you're Chinese, whether you're in Taiwan, Hong Kong or mainland China, there is a growing sense of awareness of the importance of playing a political role, and they don't want just to give it up too easily.
Could I just go back one move?
Please.
Because as well as covering the Hong Kong talks, I was actually in Beijing immediately before Tiananmen Square. And the effect of that was it was a very immature but quite spontaneous, almost revolutionary movement. And the feeling of being there was, in a lot of ways, absolutely terrifying. This was complete chaos, complete breakdown of law and order. Immediately before martial law was declared, which was actually almost 2 weeks before the tanks descended on Tiananmen Square itself, what you had was police being withdrawn from the streets. There was nothing. There was absolute mayhem at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. This was not a happy scene. Anybody in Beijing, you could not exist with that degree of disorder forever. What you had in Hong Kong was something quite different. It was almost, it was an orderly protest, and the protesters were very clear about the fact that they weren't actually out to destroy the place or to undo institutions. What they were about was trying to uphold a degree of order through the constitution.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Japan, where the jury may be out on the expansive program of reforms known as Abenomics, but the jury is back in on the prime minister for whom it is named. Shinzo Abe's Liberal Democratic Party won a thumping majority in the weekend's elections. Their coalition with the Kumaito Party will command 325 out of 475 available seats in the Diet. Alessio, first of all, the asterisk against this election result is that a record low turnout of only 35%. Why were the Japanese so unenthused about this election?
I think, first of all, they weren't expecting it. The Japanese were all sort of in a hold-on position, as it were. They were waiting for the Abe government to deliver policy. And so nobody really was expecting this a snap election. But I think what is interesting about it is that, well, this election says three things, really. One, that the opposition to the government in political terms just does not exist. And, with such a low turnout, we actually have very similar outcome in terms of seats compared to the last time the elections were around, which means really that this was a fight for the government to lose and for the DPJ, the Democratic Party of Japan, to pick it up. They just didn't. And I think that's a tremendous amount of disorganization. So whatever the formula of Abenomics is and whatever our reservations about, about it, there wasn't anything as an alternative proposed to the Japanese people, hence part of the low turnout. On a second level, I think this is very important because it puts Prime Minister Abe very much in the driving seat insofar as deciding how to play his cards. We all know that Abenomics implies a number of risks to be taken, some of which might not actually pay off. But again, he's got this new renewed mandate. He can now use, he's got a lease of extension for the, at least the next 2 years. He's proved that after a very long time of perennial transition, Japanese politics now, they are, at least on the surface, on a much more stable, balanced footing. And of course, at the third level, I think is part of the reforms itself. Now Abe has the confidence to turn around and tell its electorate, particularly those who are more reluctant to join in certain controversial measures, like the reinterpretation of the Article 9 and the meaning of collective self-defense, tackling problems like the agricultural lobbies, the car industry, reforming the labor market. So these are all sort of elements of the story. They're very controversial, and some of the proposed plans weren't particularly sort of pleasing to the Japanese people. So I think in that respect, he's bought himself some breathing space to get better on track and sell it the way he wants.
Mary, the conventional wisdom in most advanced democracies is that the economy trumps everything. It's the, you know, it's the economy stupid, as James Carville once told Bill Clinton. Japan is back in recession. The Nikkei actually went down on this election result. Has Shinzo Abe flouted that common wisdom, or is it just that there, you know, no one likes the alternatives?
I think it's a lot about nobody liking the alternatives. I think it's also that people are sort of, they're fed up, they're bored, they didn't understand why they had to go to the polls, so half of them didn't. They're not so opposed to what Abe is doing that they would come out and vote against him. It's really for him now to show that he can use the power that he's got. He's now bought himself essentially a six-year term, if you go back to when he came to power, which is what presidents in quite a few other countries have, 6 years, which is considered a decent space to get something done. And really, the buck stops now with him. He's got to show that having asked for an additional mandate, he can use it.
Alessio, another plank of, Abenomics, would you call it, Abe foreign policy, Abe strategy? There's a word there somewhere. But obviously, and we've talked about this before, he's very keen on Japan adopting a more assertive position as regards being a military country, as regards being an exporter of arms. Is he going to feel like he has a renewed mandate for that?
Again, I think as we both previously with Mary, we completely agree on this, that he's got a sense of renewed sense of direction and the strength under his belt to actually go and do it. To what extent? Here the question really is the small print, and it's about how far he's ready to push it. Well, we already know that he wanted to change the constitution, and he realized that the Japanese people were against it, full stop. And so he sort of went back on plan B, which is the reinterpretation. Now, reinterpretation is an interesting word if you think about it, because it allows you for a lot of flexibility in terms of how far you can push it. It seems to me that given the current circumstances, what Prime Minister Abe will focus on is having a Japan that can more easily present itself as a valid military partner in Northeast Asia to the United States, in progressively reintegrating military power as part of the tool of statecraft in foreign and security policy in areas that are of immediate importance to Japanese security. And that obviously means the South China Sea and possibly the Indian Ocean. So what we're looking at is probably a series of reforms that would allow the Japanese to operate more closely with actors like Australia, as well as the United States, India, in the Indian Ocean and South China Sea, respectively, and of course, make it more of a conventional stance, a conventional deterrence posture against China in Northeast Asian theatre.
Mary, given that point Alessio has just raised, that Abe may be running out a bit ahead of where his people are on the idea of Japan being a significant military power, how far do you think he'd be willing to push his luck in the next 4 years?
Well, I think in a lot of ways that doesn't depend solely on him. It depends obviously on the mood of Japanese voters, but at the same time I think it depends colossally and crucially on what China does, because what China does is going to determine how Japan reacts. Japan, I don't think, is going to take any great initiative other than refreshing and confirming the alliances that it's already got. But I think that if China were to do anything sudden and maybe less expected in the South China Sea, then we're going to see possibly more aggressive defensive stance from Japan than you would have under a previous leader.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Alessio Patalano and Mary Dajewski. When we return, we'll be looking at Europe, discussing yet more close encounters in international airspace and yet more anger at austerity.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Alessio Patalano and Mary Dajewski. And now, if one theme has defined the international strategic picture in 2014, it's been a resurgence in Russian belligerence to a pitch not seen since the hauling down of the hammer and sickle. Not content with annexing a portion of Ukraine and starting a war in another part of the same country, Moscow has also rediscovered the joy of provocative incursions into foreign airspace and territorial waters. Today, Russia's ambassadors to Sweden and Denmark have been summoned for a wigging after an SAS jet taking off from Copenhagen last Friday was forced to change course to avoid a Russian surveillance aircraft. Mary, first of all, this has been happening quite a lot this year. Last week, Finland had to order a bunch of jets to change course to avoid Russian aircraft flying without transponders. Leaving aside the fact that given the whole, you know, MH17 thing, this all seems in pretty poor taste. What's the point of any of this from Moscow's point of view?
Well, I think what we are seeing is a one-sided picture. We are seeing the what I would call a lot of the scaremongering from the Western side, from the Scandinavians, obviously from the Baltic states, from the Poles, and a bit of chorus strengthening from behind from the British, accusing Russia of flying either not in its airspace or so close to other people's airspace, but still just about within international law, in international airspace, that it becomes dangerous. And of course, flying without transponders is absolutely, you know, that is not something that anybody should do. The problem is that, as I see it, Russia is not acting just because it fancies taking some planes close to other people's borders. It's behaving like this because NATO planes and NATO troops are doing something quite similar rather close to Russia's borders. But we don't hear about that. There was a military exercise, a NATO military exercise, full dress exercise in Estonia, right up close to Russia's borders on cyber
warfare. Estonia is a member of NATO, in fairness.
It is indeed. But, you know, Russia would say, well, that's, you know, that's our border. So Russia will fly its planes close to other people's borders, and we will feel free to hold NATO exercises close to Russia's borders. We've had another NATO exercise in Ukraine since the new government took over in Ukraine. These are seen by Russia as provocations. And Russia is how far Russia is behaving in a way that is response, and how far it's behaving simply because it feels like it. I don't think without the other side of the picture, without NATO and the British and the other members of NATO saying exactly what they're doing, that we are getting the full picture.
Alessio, it has also, of course, given some Royal Air Force pilots the opportunity to take some fabulous pictures of Russian bombers flying over the North Sea. And I'm sure it is actually all jolly entertaining for the pilots and those scrambled to intercept them. But really, again, I'll put the same question to you. What's the point? And even if what Mary says is true, that this may be reaction rather than action, again, what does it actually accomplish?
Well, first of all, I think we have to look at it in the context of what happened in Ukraine and Crimea. So I don't think that the Russians are reacting. If anything, they started the entire thing. And so, you know, NATO exercises do happen all the time. The fact that this year, as opposed to other years, they decided to have scenarios that are closer to current situation just means that the people who are planning them are quite sensitive about their job. And they try to do it seriously and in a professional fashion. So where does this leave us? I think we have two different type of problems here. One is we're going back. Intellectually, we have to rediscover strategy in a very conventional state-on-state dimension, which is something that we've not been doing this for quite some time. 15 years of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan do have a heavy toll in terms of pretty much everybody who's involved in that business to understand old-fashioned conventional deterrence. So part of it is at the moment is there is a general disorientation. And I think the Russians are, in a way, taking advantage of that disorientation by making a statement. The eastern part of Europe is under our influence, full stop. So that's one level. I think on the other hand, there is another level that is much more worrisome, I think. Russian behavior, and in this respect, is not that similar, for example, to what Chinese behavior looks like in the South China Sea or in the East China Sea, is to push the boundaries of international law, particularly the freedom of overflight, the freedom of navigation. And so the funding principles of the current international order, and they're dangerously playing with that. How long do we have to wait until all these practices do amount to a new tendency, a new trend that undermines the fundamental of these principles? I think this is a very important element of the story. It's the biggest casualty of the current sort of conventional deterrent games, and is the one that the international community should really be concerned about.
But I think at the same time that in some ways, it shows the durability of the current order, because on both sides, whether it's action or reaction, what we're seeing is people flying as close as they possibly can to the border, to the point where they do not actually transgress on international law or other people's borders. Now, the problem here is, of course, a very practical problem that people make mistakes, and it's incredibly, incredibly dangerous because of the fine judgments and the accidents that can happen. So, you know, I wouldn't want to sort of downplay any of this, but I do think that maybe the international borders in the air as on the ground have actually held up quite well.
Well, finally tonight, we need to look at Belgium, which is not often thought of as a hotbed of civil unrest, but the country has been brought to a more or less complete standstill today by a general strike. Offices and schools are closed, ports are blocked, hundreds of flights have been cancelled, and the Eurostar isn't stopping at Brussels. Alessio, a lot of people will be surprised by this because we've become accustomed to anti-austerity protests, which is what this is, in the countries further south, which are considered the Eurozone basket cases, you know, Spain, Portugal, Greece, etc. How bad is Belgium? I mean, economically, I'm not mean in terms of, you know, cuisine, culture, etc., etc. It's a fine place to visit in many respects.
Well, I suppose that the heart of these protests, of these strikes, there is also an element of fundamental disconnect, if you want, between the current political trend, which is governments across Europe realizing that they have to tighten the belts, and this is not just something that happened to sort of southern of the Alps type of countries, but pretty much across the board, and the expectation that we now have in terms of labour market on how we get on. Excuse me, how we guarantee sort of jobs on a long period and long term. So what we really are looking at is a new type of dialogue that is spreading across Europe, whereby governments on one hand are saying, well, we have to have austerity measures in place, but on the other hand, they say nothing about how you reform the labour market, and they try to convince and take with them the unions in terms of where do we go? What is the ultimate goal that we're looking at? Is it like keeping employment alive or making our employment sort of in terms of output more suitable for the current situation? And having that kind of dialogue, not many are having it, mostly because they were either unprepared or they thought they would not come to that. And I think Belgium does fall into this category.
Mary, why does Belgium seem to be angrier and less content than, for example, Luxembourg or the Netherlands?
Well, you've quoted those two countries, but of course, if you look in the other direction and look, you're looking towards France, which is pretty
point.
Cross and pretty unhappy. Mm. But I think, on a slightly lighter note, it is quite interesting for such a complete and effective general strike to take place anywhere in the current day and age, but especially Belgium, because Belgium seems unable to get its act together on the official political governmental front.
It famously has gone years at a stretch without a government.
Absolutely. But it seems that the people and the unions, suddenly they can get their act together. Yes. And I mean, Belgium was basically shut down for today, which is quite a spectacular thing to achieve.
And we are going to rise above all the punchlines about whether or not anybody noticed. We will have to leave it there. Mary Dujewski and Alessio Patilano, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Police in Sydney say the cafe siege is over. Australian commandos stormed the premises, ending a siege by a gunman identified as an Iranian refugee who took dozens of people hostage. Paramedics carrying stretchers followed the commandos towards the cafe. The Turkish president Tayyip Erdogan has lashed out at the European Union after it criticised the mass arrest of opposition journalists at the weekend. Mr. Erdogan said the EU should mind its own business and keep its own opinions to itself, denying that the raids had infringed press freedom. The UN says around 4,700 people have died in Ukraine's separatist conflict since September. That's when a ceasefire was technically declared. The UN says there have been repeated shelling in the east of the country between government forces and pro-Russian rebels. Hong Kong authorities have arrested several pro-democracy activists as they clear the last of three protest sites. The move marks the closure of demonstration camps in the city that have blocked streets for more than 2 months. At least 51 people are now known to have died from a mudslide that engulfed a village in Indonesia. More than 50 people are still missing from Friday's incident in Jemblung village on the island of Java. A gunman suspected of killing 5 people in 3 separate locations in Pennsylvania is believed to be barricaded inside a home. SWAT officers and an armored vehicle responded to the scene as other authorities could be seen outside the home. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life. A benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House. You're live on Monocle 24. It's time now for us to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Toronto, from where we are joined by Chris Frey. Chris, welcome back to the programme. First of all, it's a story we've talked about in various other contexts on various other programmes, but the continuing fall in oil prices is good news for some people, like motorists and airlines. It's less good news for countries like Canada, whose economy is hugely dependent on oil.
Yeah, well, I'd actually suggest it's a split, and that's sort of the nature of the dynamics of the country right now. The oil that is extracted from the tar sands in northern Alberta is among the world's most expensive and dirtiest to produce, which means the fall in prices is putting a squeeze on companies, so their profits and future development plans. Already, several companies have announced layoffs and postponement of new facilities. Meanwhile, energy stocks have really taken a beating. But meanwhile, we've seen this tension play out between Western Canada, which is more of an energy-driven economy, and the traditional industrial powerhouse in Ontario and Quebec, which have suffered as, I guess, the dollar has boomed or has been driven upwards by oil prices. So what we're actually seeing is Alberta taking a beating, But Central Canada getting a bit of getting a respite, I guess, as the dollar proceeds to drop. I mean, it was up near par with the American dollar, you know, within the last year. Now they're anticipating prices are, you know, a dollar somewhere around 82 cents. So that does alleviate a lot of the pressure on those, you know, on the industrial heartland of the country. Something Prime Minister Harper really hasn't, you know, done much himself with.
So what sort of tone are the Canadian media taking about this? Are they being fairly equivocal and just realizing that these things are basically swings and roundabouts, or is there any sort of concern setting in?
Well, it happens at several levels. Obviously, with the talks that just happened in Lima and Prime Minister Harper's, you know, unwillingness to commit to any, you know, solid goals in terms of carbon emissions, there's obviously the environmental angle on the story. As we've also discussed on the program before, there's the controversial oil pipelines, one built to the West Coast that would serve, you know, oil up to Asia, the other one to the U.S. So, you know, it also feeds into that debate. But as I said, I think in Central Canada, there is that sense of relief. And the media is also, I think, very smartly pointing out really what underlines Prime Minister Harper's resource-based approach to economic development, and that is, you know, what a risky, I guess, plank it is in his strategy. When oil prices are high enough, you know, to cover the cost of extracting bitumen from the tar sands, there are some genuine economic spin-offs that create jobs across the country. But I think overall, the country hasn't made that transition yet to more coherent policy where perhaps the energy industry can be well served. But there is some stimulus and some concern given to that industrial heartland, which has struggled.
Okay, well, another story that we often talk about here on Monocle 24 in various different contexts is the increasingly vigorous anti-corruption drive being undertaken in China by the regime of Xi Jinping. I understand that anti-corruption drive has somehow reached Canada's shores now.
Yes, well, despite the absence of a formal extradition treaty between the two countries, Canada has agreed to offer some assistance in the Chinese government's high-profile crackdown on corruption. Canada, along with the U.S., has been one of the likeliest destinations for Chinese fleeing prosecution on corruption charges, including one of the country's most wanted men, Lai Changqing. He was accused by Chinese authorities of running a multi-billion dollar smuggling operation. He arrived in Canada in 99, seeking refugee status, insisting that the charges against him were politically motivated. And it took more than a decade of negotiations until Canada finally returned him in 2011. As you know, like, Western countries have resisted signing extradition deals with China, partly out of concern about the integrity of its judicial system, the treatment of prisoners, and the possible application of the death penalty. But yes, I mean, as President Xi Jinping has intensified his campaign, Western governments, I guess, like Canada and the U.S., have started to display a greater willingness to at least cooperate. I think last month as well, China asked the U.S. for help in finding 100 fugitives that they think are located there.
What do we know about what the terms of this deal are? As you rightly mentioned, Canada, along with many other Western countries, doesn't like extraditing people back to somewhere where they may face the death penalty, which is a potential penalty for corruption charges in China. Has it been sort of acknowledged that some sort of deal has been done over the possible capital punishment?
Not explicitly yet, and I think when the word first came out this morning, the Foreign Minister, John Baird, was yet to make an announcement. So I think we're still awaiting details on that count, but I think the fact that Lai Changqing only faced a lifetime prison sentence instead of a death sentence, that may have given the Canadians some, you know, some further confidence that they could make this deal.
And finally, Chris, the City of Champions is no more.
Do you know what the City of Champions is?
The City of Champions was Edmonton until really quite recently.
Yes. Well, once upon a time, inspired by around, I guess, the 5 Stanley Cup championships, that would be the most important trophy in professional ice hockey.
And therefore pretty much the most important thing in Canada, right?
Well, yes, I guess. So it was back, but this was back in the 1980s, you know, and you may remember superstar Wayne Gretzky, and that's when he was around with the team. So, you know, we're 3 decades removed from that City of Championships time. For the past decade, its team, the Edmonton Oilers, has routinely found itself in the cellar of the league standings. But on the other hand, the city itself has fared much better than the team, largely on the back of the Alberta oil boom we were just discussing. And over the next few years, a slate of downtown renewal projects worth up to $5 billion expect to bring some much-needed revitalization to the heart of the city. So, it's interesting. I mean, I think they're to be, you know, applauded for this. It's a sign of what they themselves call civic maturity that they're dropping the City of Champions tag. It's going to be erased from all the welcome boards that you see upon entering the city. There is no word yet on what the new slogan will be. One just hopes it predictably doesn't have something to do with oil.
How can it not have anything to do with oil, though? If you're going to try and rebrand Edmonton, and you're not going to use the hockey team, who, by the way, obviously are called the Oilers anyway, what else does Edmonton have? Where else could they be looking?
Well, they have a Canadian professional football team. It is a cold city. I think they can take some justifiable pride. It's a weird place. Edmonton is in the northern part of Alberta, and it's the city nearest to the oil sands. Although Calgary itself, its rival, would be really where the business heart of the oil sands lie. It's an interestingly multicultural place that you find up in the sort of northern wastelands, and its population now approaching 1 million people. It's sort of, you know, a weird blue-collar place that has a strange progressive streak, which is unique in very conservative Alberta.
On that note, welcome to Edmonton, a weird blue-collar place with a strange progressive streak. I can see that on license plates, Chris. Chris Frey in Toronto, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau.
Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, joins us now from Tokyo. Can you explain a little bit about this turnaround in price?
The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House.
They're claiming that these are going to be the most compact games of all time.
And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. Plus, don't forget the Daily Monologue, an op-ed piece from one of Monocle's globe-trotting editors. From the sublime to the occasionally ever so slightly ridiculous, find out what the minds inside Midori House are thinking. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
It's the art of publishing with skates on. Here it comes. Monocle Alpino. Here's what some of our Wrapped Up for the Elements editors have for you this winter.
In the design section, we look to the dark, gloomy High North, where one town is staying lit up during the winter with some cleverly placed mirrors.
In the edit section, we brave the elements to explore a few mountain recipes. We also meet three brewers making gin, whiskey and beer at altitude, and snuggle up to the best in accommodation, from a French chalet on the up to a glacier-side lodge in Greenland.
Monocle Alpino is on newsstands now. For more information and Monocle subscriptions, head to monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, for Philistines and art lovers alike, the idea of art ending up in the so-called wrong hands tends to invite an opinion. The recent outrage over the British Museum's loan of part of the Elgin Marbles to Russia's Hermitage Gallery being just one case in point. A new book on looted art through the centuries takes a look at what motivates the world's top looters and art thieves and explores the efforts made to get previous works back where they belong. That book is The History of Loot and Stolen Art from Antiquity Until the Present Day by Ivan Lindsay, who joined Monocle's Thomas Lewis earlier.
Throughout the book, I'd look at what I think are the most interesting looters and what they took. And there are so many through the book. It's hard to single out any particular one, but you have all these different people who got into a position of enormous power. And when they got to that position, they took what they wanted, whether it was Hitler or Stalin, Napoleon. They all had motives, and they went after huge quantities of art. And within those major stories, there are many sort of smaller stories of individual looting. I think it is an interesting subject, and people are fascinated with the whole idea of looting and stealing art, even to the present day.
Well, there is a certain allure to this idea of these masterpieces that go missing or that are stolen, that are hidden away. I remember a few years ago I studied the Amber Room in just outside St. Petersburg, which of course is a story that conspiracy theorists as well as art historians are still sort of fascinated by. Would you say that actually, you know, these might be sort of retold in more sort of popular vocabulary, in sort of maybe a bit of a glamorous way, or a way where intrigue is really at the heart of the story. But the damage done by looting art is actually very real, isn't it? If you think of, say, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the scenes of the National Museum in Baghdad and these artifacts being carted out very casually from this masterpiece of a museum. And those effects, really, it's really difficult to know when those wounds will heal, when those collections will ever be complete, if ever again. From your book, how do you assess kind of when something goes missing, when something is stolen, kind of actually the effect it leaves behind?
I think in some ways the effect never heals, and the repercussions of looting and stolen art, they just keep echoing around, and it doesn't matter if it was Napoleonic thefts or First World War, Second World War. You mentioned Iraq. Now we have Syria. We have the Elgin Marbles raising their head again. All these stories, they just keep reverberating. And I don't think those wounds ever heal properly.
In the book, do you draw a distinction between, would you say the looting of figures like Stalin or Hitler, for whatever motives of power that were driving them in terms of building up these collections, and say a figure like Lord Elgin? And of course that story is back in the news again, that the Elgin Marbles have gone to the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg to mark a big anniversary there. How do you distinguish between those kinds of looting? What are the degrees of looting and taking something that isn't yours in the first place?
That's a very good question, but the answer is extremely complicated. The Elgin Marbles, the question is whether they were looted or not, and I examined that in the book, and I did a very careful analysis of all that. I mean, Hitler and Stalin, you mentioned, they clearly were looting. They were removing objects by force during conflict that didn't belong to them, whereas Elgin is a different example. He actually obtained contracts to remove what he did and brought them back, and then the legality of his removal was debated in Parliament before Parliament bought the marbles from him. And then they were vested in the British Museum, which looks after artworks on behalf of the British people. So actually they belong to the British people now. So Elgin is not an example I would connect with Hitler and Stalin's looting, actually. I would say that's completely different.
So what is the conclusion, say, to a story like the Elgin Marbles? And it's a case that really does conjure huge emotions. Obviously, the Greek government is really, the pressure from them is still incredibly intense to get these artefacts returned. And how do you categorise, again, then, the difference between, you know, the find, for example, in a Munich apartment of artworks that were looted by the Nazis that were in the possession of an 82-year-old man, to something that, like you say, has been incorporated into Britain, for example, in the case of the Elgin Marbles? How do you take away the emotion and sort of do it through a sort of proper framework? You know, does it differ from case to case depending on what was taken and how? Or actually, is there something more universal that we can look at when we think about where artworks belong and the ideas of ownership, therefore?
To start with, Cornelis Gurlitt, who had all those artworks in Munich, some of those were clearly looted during the Nazi period. Elgin and his marbles, the marbles just gone off to the Hermitage, which has caused this furore. I actually personally think that was a magnificent gesture, and I prefer cultural exchange. I think we should keep cultural lines of communication open, even when we have political differences. And the Russians, for instance, this year have lent Malevich paintings to Britain for the Malevich exhibition, and they lent the paintings from the Hermitage to Houghton. So they're freely lending to Britain. I think it's wonderful that we lend them one of the marbles. I see it's a very emotional subject for the Greeks, and I completely understand that. But it's very hard to talk about giving the marbles back when, where would Britain stop? Would they give back the Ashanti gold to Ghana? Would they give back the Benin bronzes to Nigeria? Would they give back the Ethiopian tablets to Ethiopia? The list goes on and on and on. It's not just the British Museum, but the Louvre and the Metropolitan in New York. If all the museums started clearing themselves out and sending everything back to its country of origin, there wouldn't be anything left in museums. So it's a difficult subject.
And when you look at an institution like the British Museum, for example, or the Louvre, these are institutions where it's not just about the display or the or curating marvelous things and beautiful things and putting them together. These are populated with world-class specialists who look after these things and give them a home where they will survive for generations to come. When we come back, therefore, just finally, to the idea of looted art and artworks that are taken away, would you say, therefore, that there is a case when things have, by whatever path, ended up, say, in Paris or in London or in New York, that actually the case to keep them there and the case to keep them open for people from all over the world to keep seeing them and experiencing them is actually pretty strong, and therefore the emotional case therefore sort of diminishes slightly from those countries who want them back?
I think absolutely. I think the British Museum is there for the world, and they last year they had 6.7 million people. It's free, it's in a terrific time zone, equidistant between America and Asia. It's very well curated, as you point out. And you look at those arguments, and then you look at the emotional arguments of those people who really want their items back. But I think there is definitely a case for these museums to remain as they are.
That was Ivan Lindsay, author of The History of Loot and Stolen Art, speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming up for the end of the show, which means it's time for our daily arts review. Today, we're talking about a couple of new exhibitions in New York, and we're joined now by the art critic Shana Beth Mason. Shana, welcome to the show. Before we get into the exhibitions, though, I understand you wanted to talk about not so much artistry, but activism. This is artists responding online to the recent protests over the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner.
Yes, I've been noticing that a few artists have become quite vocal, and you know, to protect themselves, I wouldn't mention names. It's just something of a proliferation that I'm seeing about being more vocal, about being more aware of, you know, the protesting and that's been happening nationwide here regarding the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. And like all civilians, like all citizens, artists are a part of it, and I think that their response is as important as anybody else going into the street. And a few images that I've seen show artists at the Million Man March that was happening over the last couple of days here in New York City. Artists were actually taking part.
How important do you think an artistic response is to situations like this, and what difference do you think it can make? Especially, I mean, there's a long history of art being created in protest against things, but in a day when, you know, in an age in which news cycles can come and go in a matter of minutes, is it hard to create anything of worthwhile, lasting worth?
I agree with you. I think it is hard to create anything that's pertinent and new, especially since art and contemporary art, in which, you know, in the circles in which I operate as a critic, tend to apply to a very small sector of the public. You know, you can't walk into the Metropolitan Museum and see a huge retrospective on protest art. That would be nice, by the way. But it tends to be that activist art gets lost to the annals of art criticism or art theory. And I'm sure that these artists would be disappointed in that their own feelings, their own personal ruse on, you know, social elements, civil elements, get lost in that way to a larger audience.
Okay, well, we'll move along to art that people can actually go and see, although much of it created a bit more or a bit longer ago than the present day. Deborah Cass, you wanted to talk about first.
Yes, and I'm really enjoying seeing her art. I actually saw one of her fabulous pieces. It's called Double Yentl, My Elvis, when I was down in Miami quite recently. She's a 62-year-old artist. She's based here in Brooklyn, and she was recently elected to the board of directors for the Andy Warhol Foundation in Pittsburgh. And she has turned art history on its head, so to speak, with her works that have indeed played on, you know, typical masculine notions that, you know, Warhol played with and other artists, other super masculine artists in, you know, the guise of history, such as Ellsworth Kelly and Frank Scala and Jasper Johns. So she has, you know, a wonderful series of works that really, you know, put a new spin on this machismo, patriarchal art history that we like to call it.
So what's she doing now and where can it be seen?
Well, the most recent work, as I was mentioning briefly, the most recent work is one of her is one of an ongoing series. It's a very, very large double print of the actress Barbara Streisand dressed as her character of Yentl in the self-titled movie, the movie that she directed and produced and wrote. And it is a play on Warhol's double Elvis. And that piece, a very, very large double Yentl, can be seen at the Perez Art Museum in Miami in a new show called Global Positioning Systems. And she's also represented by the Paul Kasman Gallery here in New York, so her work can be seen there as well.
Okay, and you wanted to talk also about an exhibition of the work of Betty Tompkins, which I think it's fair to say would be an audacious suggestion for a first date.
Quite. I've gotten to know Betty Tompkins over the last couple of years, and as a 68-year-old artist who has just become, I'd say, widely prominent, yes, it would be quite audacious. The show called Smooch at 55 Gansevoort just recently closed, but she's in a current exhibition called Rear Window at the Louis B. James Gallery in the Lower East Side that shows a few of her paintings that are lifted from vintage pornography stills. But the paintings themselves are paintings. They're made very delicately with hundreds upon hundreds of layers of airbrushing. And they're built on a series of words. So the word, like, for example, which is not safe for radio, it's made hundreds and hundreds of times. And then the airbrushing is done over it as kind of a structure. So she's been doing this now since 1969. And yes, as a first date, I don't know if it would be considerably demure material.
Where does her work actually figure now, though? Because obviously the paintings for which she's best known, which were these enormous and incredibly realistic pictures of extremely close-up intercourse, probably had something more of a power to shock in the early 70s when, you know, they weren't the kind of thing you saw every time you clicked on a random link.
I think it's more, she would suggest that the shock value is more that they were created by a woman versus the content itself. It was not unusual to see these types of images in a gentleman's magazine or, you know, some sort of, you know, adult television program. But the fact that these were being created by a woman was taking control of the imagery, was more shocking to a general audience than the actual content. And nowadays, it still does have the power to offend some, which is difficult to imagine given the proliferation of this kind of imagery. But believe it or not, it still does. You know, Betty is quite active on social media herself, and hundreds of times her imagery has been removed.
But you still think it does still have something to say now? It's not just it isn't just a relic of a pre-internet age.
Absolutely. I think that her work has even more to offer a new audience, in that it's showing people how to look at these images rather than what they're looking at. It's more of the mastery of a painter rather than someone who's capable of copying an image. And that is very, very telling in an age of social media where copying, pasting, repetition is so common, and these cannot be repeated. These images are incredibly labor-intensive, and they cannot be redone in an instant.
Shana Beth Mason in Brooklyn, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests earlier in the show, Alessio Patilano and Mary Dajewski. The show was produced by Alice Block and researched by David Pleasant. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Up after the headlines, we have Culture with Rob Bound at 2200, The Monocle Daily, and Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye, and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.